CFRC 101.9 FM has launched applications for its 2026 Airwave YGK Musicians in Residence program. Young emerging artists are invited to come create new music in our studios, perform it live on air, attend industry workshops, get paid, and get studio recordings and video to build their artistic portfolios. Applications are live now via CFRC.ca and open through December 31st. Airwave YGK Musician Residencies are made possible through the support of the City of Kingston and Kingston Arts Council. Local lives here at CFRC. Apply today so we can amplify your talent tomorrow.
Communications.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus community radio station, broadcasting to you since 1920.
CFRC's funding drive is running through December 31st. Donate now, get great new CFRC swag and gifts from local businesses. And for every $5 you donate, you can also enter to win this week's raffle featuring gifts from Novel Idea, Terra Natural Foods, Mighty Bird, Pokeworks, The Grad Club, and The Fun Zone at 541 Days Road, Kingston's top-rated birthday party venue featuring arcades, laser tag, and more. Local lives here. Help local radio amplify local voices. Making a gift to support CFRC is super easy. Donate today via CFRC.ca.
It's a story of the best and worst of human nature. The story of AIDS from the beginning.
When I asked my doctor what my mortality would be, he didn't have an answer.
Their roommates have kicked them out. They've been served on paper plates. Their families have disowned them. It's horrifying.
Tonight, we are marching as are others across America, and we shouldn't have to be.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Ghana is poised to outlaw queer sex, coming out, and advocacy. The Dominican Republic's High Court ends the ban on same-gender sex for cops and military service members. And rage and resilience in the early years of AIDS. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Ava Davis.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending November 22nd, 2025. Ghana is once again poised to outlaw coming out or even advocating for LGBTQ rights. President John Dramani Mahama announced this week that he intends to sign the measure, an action his predecessor, President Nana Akufo-Addo, had delayed. Under the promotion of proper human sexual rights and Ghanaian Family Values Bill, publicly identifying as queer or transgender or having same-gender sex can carry 3 to 5 year prison sentences. Forming or funding a queer advocacy group or promoting queer rights at all is worth up to 10 years behind bars. Landlords who knowingly rent to queer tenants can even be jailed for up to 6 years. Parliament overwhelmingly passed the measure in February 2024 during Akufo-Addo's administration. He asked the Supreme Court to confirm its legality before he would sign it. The High Court eventually rejected 2 challenges to the bill, but it died without Akufo-Addo's signature when his term ended in January of this year. The current version of the bill was introduced in Parliament by a bipartisan group in October, and it's expected to receive overwhelming support. However, it's not yet clear whether it totally mirrors all the provisions of the original proposal. Gay sex was first outlawed in 1892, when the West African nation was a British colony. Lawmakers downgraded the offense to a misdemeanor in the 1960 Ghanaian Criminal Code. The current bill raises the level of the charges again. President Mahama told the Christian Council of Ghana that he is completely aligned with the group in support of the bill, according to Modern Ghana. He assured the attendees of the November 18th meeting in Accra, "We agree with the Speaker to relay the bill and let Parliament debate it. And if it comes to me as President, I will sign it. Of course, global and domestic human rights groups are condemning the renewed anti-queer legislation. They warn that its passage would violate rights enshrined in the Ghanaian Constitution, including freedom of speech and association, and equal protection and non-discrimination guarantees.
The Dominican Republic's national police and armed forces members are no longer barred from having intimate same-gender relationships. The Constitutional Court overturned those statutes in a November 20th opinion, finding that the queer sex ban lacked a legitimate constitutional interest or aim to strengthen and improve institutional efficiency. Until now, police or military officers who broke the law faced up to 2 years in prison. Like their heterosexual counterparts, LGBTQ officers may not enter relationships with each other. Human Rights Watch senior LGBT researcher Christiane Gonzalez-Cabrera applauded the court ruling. His organization filed an amicus brief in the case last year. To him, the victory is a resounding affirmation that a more inclusive future is both possible and required under Dominican law. Cabrera and other equality advocates hope that the high court ruling opens the door to more rights advances. In his words, President Luis Abinader and Congress should use the momentum of this landmark ruling to advance long overdue protections for LGBT people.
New Zealand's underage transgender people will be denied puberty blockers as of December 19th. Health Minister Simeon Brown announced the ban for patients under 18 in a November 19th social media post. Brown echoes a similar ban in the United Kingdom, based on the findings of the highly disputable CAS review. That controversial report questions the established science concerning such therapy, proving its safety and its sometimes literally life-saving outcomes. Without citing credible evidence, CAS urges healthcare providers to use extreme caution in offering puberty blockers to pediatric patients. That led to their indefinite ban in the UK pending the completion of a clinical trial in 2031. As in the UK, trans pediatric patients in New Zealand who are currently using puberty blockers can continue. Prescriptions for the treatment of early onset puberty, prostate cancer, or other specific conditions are not affected. Elizabeth McElrea is vice president of the Professional Association for Transgender Health at Orea. She believes that puberty blockers have been prescribed safely for decades for transgender children. McElrea warns, the ban will lead to worsening mental health, increased suicidality, and dysphoria for gender-diverse children and young people, and will put them at a higher risk of experiencing marginalization and discrimination.
Victoria is honoring Transgender Day of Remembrance by becoming the first Australian state to offer free birth certificate gender marker updates. Until now, it costs trans and gender-diverse people more than $140 to file the required documents. Capping Trans Awareness Week, Minister for Government Services Natalie Hutchins announced on November 20th, "We're making sure money isn't an obstacle for trans and gender diverse people to have documents that reflect who they really are." The application fee for a name change will also be waived if the request is made along with the gender marker change, as will postage within Australia. Trans Victorians have been allowed to change the gender marker on their birth certificates without surgery since 2020. Transgender Day of Remembrance commemorates trans lives lost to violence and puts a spotlight on the bias faced by trans people around the world, most notably impacting trans women of color. Minister for Equality Vicky Ward called this week's action an empowering measure that provides fair and proper legal recognition of transgender people's lived identity.
Finally, a former Federal Bureau of Investigation intelligence specialist filed suit this week because he says that his pride flag display was constitutionally protected expression and that he was fired simply because he's a proud gay man. David Maltinsky had worked at the FBI since 2009 in operational support and then in an intelligence role. His lawsuit contends that he had displayed the pride flag for several years after it was given to him in recognition of his diversity initiatives. Two supervisors in the Los Angeles field office had approved the display. Suddenly, he received a letter from FBI Director Kash Patel on October 1st explaining that he was being fired for an inappropriate display of political signage. That was just 3 weeks before Maltinsky was set to graduate as a special agent from the FBI Academy's basic field training courses. He had successfully passed all major legal and physical requirements before Patel unceremoniously fired him. Soon after he became its director, Patel banned official LGBTQ pride celebrations at all FBI facilities, but his actions against Maltinsky seemed to be particularly vindictive. The lawsuit filed at the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia asked the court to reinstate Maltinsky, award back pay, and rule that the government cannot punish employees for LGBTQ+ identity or expression. To quote lead counsel Christopher M. Mattei's press statement, "This case is about far more than one man's career. It's about whether the government can punish Americans simply for saying who they are. Thanks to David's courage, Patel will be held to account for his unconstitutional assault on Americans who simply want to serve their country as they are."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending November 22nd, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian Chazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text to this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine.
And now it's time to set our dials back with the Rainbow Rewind, your look at the moments, milestones, and memories that shape our queer journey.
From hard-won victories to cultural firsts, from the unknown to the iconic legends,
we celebrate the people and events that remind us how far we've come and how far we still shine. I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lunn. This week, we celebrate icons of art and activism. Benjamin Britten, an influential English composer known for his operas like Peter Grimes and War Requiem, was born on November 22, 1913. Here's a clip from Immortal Fire, The Gay Life of Benjamin Britten, produced by Hugh Young and narrated by Barry Empson. This piece from the This Way Out archives originally aired on November 25th, 1988.
Present Immortal Fire, The Gay Life of Benjamin Britten.
It was never publicly mentioned in his lifetime. Instead, homophobic critics sniped wildly at his music, even finding sadism in his liking for the percussion instrument called the whip, actually two sticks struck together, the same thing as the slapstick of old comedies. And here, it stands for the rigging on Noah's Ark, flapping during a storm. Naturally enough, gayness as such is seldom if ever referred to directly in Britten's work. The nearest we get is the unconsummated love of Aschenbach for the pubescent youth Tadzio in Britten's last opera, Death in Venice.
Yes, but when a hero...
On to more birthdays. Civil rights leader and gay activist best known for organizing the 1963 March on Washington, Bayard Rustin was born on November 25th, 1913. And on November 27th, 1940, Emmy Award-winning comedian, writer, and longtime Hollywood Squares star Bruce Valanche was born.
Now let's rewind to some key queer moments. On November 27th, 1978, openly gay San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone were assassinated.
On November 30th, 2015, the United States lifted its decades-long ban on gay and bisexual men donating blood.
That's this week's Rainbow Rewind.
Because our stories aren't just in the past, they're the pride that powers our future. I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lund. Stay tuned. More This Way Out is just ahead.
Stevens, Noah in the Noah's Ark movie and TV series, and you've discovered This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
Listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Overcoming disruption, transforming the AIDS response is the theme of this year's World AIDS Day. The UN AIDS website calls December 1st an important opportunity to highlight the impact that the funding cuts from international donors have had on the response to AIDS, as well as to showcase the resilience of countries and communities stepping up to protect the gains made and drive the HIV response forward. It's an ironic flashback to the early years of the pandemic when the U.S. government was in denial and LGBTQ people banded together to meet the moment. This Way Out's David Hunt started covering the AIDS beat for Pacifica Radio more than 40 years ago and remembers what it was like.
What do you know about the history of AIDS, the acquired immune deficiency syndrome? If you're like most people, you know that it emerged as a public health threat in the 1980s, that it struck down millions of people worldwide, including thousands of young gay men in the United States and other developed nations. You may know that the LGBTQ community and its allies mobilized to combat this relentless killer. Today, it's the stuff of legend, the story of an oppressed community fighting for its very existence in the face of social stigma, media disinformation, and government indifference. David Hunt. It's easy to romanticize the AIDS generation, the fearless, sometimes lawless activists who shut down the New York Stock Exchange to protest drug companies profiteering from the epidemic, who stormed the National Institutes of Health in Maryland to speed the delivery of new treatments, who raised millions of dollars for AIDS research and created a social service infrastructure to care for the ill and the dying. But at the beginning of the crisis in 1981, 82, and 83, all of that lay in the future. In the early days of what would become a global pandemic, the gay and lesbian community struggled to coalesce in response to a new, confounding, and frightening disease. It's a story of the best and worst of human nature, the story of AIDS from the beginning.
When I asked my doctor what my mortality would be, he didn't have an answer.
Robert Bland wasn't alone. Nobody had reliable answers to questions about a mysterious disease that began to afflict gay men in Los Angeles and several other big cities in the U.S. in the early 1980s. When he sat down with me for a radio interview in early 1983, Bland had, at least, learned the name of his ailment, AIDS. By September, he had the answer to his question. He was dead. The disease outbreak that would claim the lives of Robert Bland and more than 40 million people worldwide was first described in the medical literature on June 5, 1981. In a U.S. government publication, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, published by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Between October 1980 and May 1981, the CDC reported, five young gay men had been treated for a rare form of pneumonia at three different hospitals in Los Angeles. Two of the patients had died. The fact that these patients were all homosexuals suggests an association between some aspect of a homosexual lifestyle or disease acquired through sexual contact, the report said. A month later, on July 3, 1981, the CDC had more troubling news. 10 additional cases of pneumocystis pneumonia had been reported in gay men, 4 in Los Angeles and 6 in San Francisco. And now doctors in New York and California had diagnosed a rare form of skin cancer, Kapsch's sarcoma, or KS for short, in 26 gay men. Some of these patients had been diagnosed as early as 1979. 8 had died. I began covering the story at that time for IMRU, a weekly gay and lesbian news program that aired on Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. By year's end, 337 cases of what was then described as gay cancer and gay pneumonia had been reported. 130 patients, nearly 40%, had died. The vast majority of those diagnosed, 94%, were young gay men. And so it would continue into 1982, with the number of new cases increasing by 5 or 6 a week, while the national media seemed largely unconcerned, and the Reagan administration remained silent on the topic. Media coverage of AIDS took a sharp turn in the summer of 1982, when doctors diagnosed cases in 3 children with hemophilia, a blood disorder that requires the regular injection of a blood clotting protein called factor VIII, a product then made by pooling plasma from thousands of donors. At the same time, researchers began reporting cases among Haitian immigrants to the United States and among people, straight and gay, who injected recreational drugs such as heroin. Instead of ignoring AIDS, the media began sensationalizing the disease. The gay plague, headlines declared, was now spreading to heterosexuals. While the gay and lesbian community struggled to coalesce in response to the AIDS epidemic, fear and panic spread, and the number of cases continued to rise, surpassing 1,100 in March 1983. That's when I traveled to San Francisco to attend the Gay and Lesbian Press Association convention. There I recorded a panel featuring Bobby Campbell, an AIDS activist who wrote a regular column called Gay Cancer Journal for the San Francisco Sentinel. Campbell asked the assembled journalists to remember the real people behind the headlines.
I think that it's important for us to realize that there is a human component to this ailment. It is not simply a headline. It is not simply something that sells advertising space. There are people that are suffering, and I am. I know that there are some horror stories about people with AIDS who have been disenfranchised of their basic rights. Their roommates have kicked them out. They've been served on paper plates. That bar tenders refuse to serve them drinks. That their lovers have kicked them out. But their families have disowned them is horrifying.
In New York City, the novelist Larry Kramer, one of the founders of a volunteer service organization called Gay Men's Health Crisis, wrote what would become one of the most influential articles in the history of gay media. The story on page 1 of the New York Native, March 27, 1983, was titled 1,112 and Counting. That was, of course, the number of AIDS cases that had been diagnosed to date since June 5, 1981, a number that was rising exponentially, then at a rate of about 5 a day. The article began, "If this article doesn't scare the shit out of you, we're in real trouble." If this article doesn't rouse you to anger, fury, rage, and action, gay men may have no future on this earth. Our continued existence depends on just how angry you can get. Unless we fight for our lives, we shall die. The article touched a nerve. Within weeks, in May 1983, candlelight demonstrations were held in five U.S. cities to raise awareness of the epidemic and to pressure the federal government to increase funding for research and treatment programs. I reported on the protests for Pacifica Radio.
In New York, 6,000 people in black armbands marched down Lower Broadway in Manhattan. At a rally near the United Nations, gay activist Bob Checkey, who has AIDS, blasted President Reagan.
If you are not present at this march, I hope somehow you will hear me. I am a man with AIDS. I'm a feeling, thinking, God-loving man with AIDS. Many of the people we took care of are dead. Many of the people we are taking care of now are dying. This saddens me, Mr. President, because all the love in the universe has not stopped the dying and will not bring back the dead. There is pain in my body, but I can live with this. There is pain in my heart, and that is what is so unbearable.
In San Francisco, more than 10,000 gays and lesbians swarmed down Castro Street. In a rare show of solidarity, gay bars and businesses closed down for the march. And here in Los Angeles, 5,000 demonstrators rallied at the Westwood Federal Building. The man responsible for the rally, Daniel Warner, made an impassioned call for action.
Tonight, we are marching as are others across America, and we shouldn't have to be. Tonight, we are pleading for our lives and the future lives of Americans, and we should not have to be.
The same week protesters gathered outside the Westwood Federal Building in Los Angeles, researchers at the Pasteur Institute in Paris announced that they had isolated the virus responsible for AIDS, a virus that would come to be called HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus. It was far from the end of the AIDS crisis. It would be years before scientists developed drug cocktails that could suppress but not eliminate HIV from the body. Even more years before they developed PrEP, an antiretroviral medication to prevent HIV infection. The Reagan administration would continue to drag its feet, slow-walking efforts to educate the public about high-risk behaviors. But protests would continue in the coming years, mobilized by groups like ACT UP and Queer Nation. Federal funding for research, treatment, education, and support would increase significantly, with federal outlays reaching nearly $10 billion a year by 1999. Gays and lesbians who would lose so many friends and lovers, tens of thousands in the coming years, would not lose everything. Millions would survive and thrive. They would come out of the closet and live their lives openly and proudly, gaining a greater measure of social acceptance and even some legal protections. If there's a lesson to be learned from the early years of the AIDS epidemic, it's that individuals can and do make a difference. In the midst of panic, fear, political infighting, and denial, some people did what they could, where they could, to raise awareness, to raise money, to raise hell. I'd like to thank the Pacifica Radio Archives and the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives for preserving some of my recordings from the 1980s. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
World AIDS Day is December 1st. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Ava Davis and Michael LeBeau and produced by Brian DeShazer. The Rainbow Rewind was written and produced by Sherry Lunn and Brian DeShazer. David Hutt produced the Early Years of AIDS feature. You heard music by Van Morrison, Janice Ian, and Michael Witt. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks John Beaupre of Los Angeles, California, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media. Email us at info@thiswayout.org or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappelle, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on WUML Lowell, Massachusetts, CJLY, Slocum Valley, New Denver, Nelson, Crawford Bay, British Columbia, KBRP, Bisbee, Arizona, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Hello, Kingston. CFRC 101.9 FM's annual funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Please consider donating today and help support local and earn the chance to win some amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, donors also earn one more ticket for each of our weekly raffle draws running in December featuring prizes from wonderful local businesses, including Gray Malkin's Wireworks, McKinnon Brothers Brewing, Old Farm Fine Foods, The Screening Room, Skin Fusion Spa, Smokes Poutinery, Paul Randolph Jewelers, Terra Natural Foods, Wit, and Thousand Islands Cruises. Enjoy the benefits of donating and help CFRC continue to be the longest running campus radio station in Canada. Donate today via CFRC.ca.
And good morning. It is 7:30 a.m. here in Kingston, Ontario. You are tuned into CFRC 101.9 FM, CFRC.ca for those of you listening in through the web. We are located in the lower level of Carruthers Hall on the beautiful Queen's campus. My name is May, and you are now listening to What's Brewing. So this week is very exciting for me because I actually got to see one of the artists that I'm going to be playing today live a couple days ago at the Grad Club. So we'll get into that more later, but we're going to start things off with Louis-Charles et Couteau. This was released as a single on November 3rd. They're a Quebec City-based alt and post-punk group, self-proclaimed musique de nuit or night music. This is their second single in anticipation of an upcoming project, Louis-Charles 2. After that, we have Shapes with In Its Way, releases a single on October 24th. This is a Montreal-based post-punk group with shared influences in 80s new wave and goth. And then finally, we have Slash Need with Cool Touch off of their debut album, Sit and Grin, released October 21st. This is a Toronto-based darkwave electronica and synth punk group. This is the group that I saw live at the Grad Club. They were absolutely amazing, absolutely incredible artistry. It was definitely an experience, and they definitely incorporate a lot of aesthetic elements into their performance. They have performers that are going through the crowd and just engaging with the crowd. An absolutely incredible show. I think one of the best that I've seen in a long time. They're actually playing November 15th in Toronto as well, so if you are feeling like you missed out and you're in Toronto for the weekend, I strongly recommend going to see them live, or if they come back to Kingston anytime soon. But without further ado, we're going to kick things off with Louis-Charles et Couteau right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. This is What's Brewing.
C'est beau quand tout vous profite. Assis dans le char en fil. Je voulais partir à Bancon. C'est beau quand tout va trop vite. Je dormirai de là. Je dormirai de là. Je dormirai de là. J'ai trouvé un clou dans un coin de ta chambre. On remue tout ce qui nous manque. Mais les lampadaires dehors me tigèrent comme un phare. C'est que la phase remonte. We'll be right back.
Sometimes screaming with nightmares in which I see myself buried alive, waiting to find myself in a tomb without air, stifling no escape.
And welcome back. You just finished listening to Cool Touch by Slash Need. Before that, we had Shapes with In Its Way. And at the very top of that set, we had Couteau by Louis Char right here on What's Brewing, CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up next, we have some more French and Montreal-based groups. We're going to start things off with Adieu Narcisse and Jamais. This was released as a single on October 14th. This is a Quebec-based multidisciplinary artist collective. They lean alternative pop, and they utilize poetry and stage performance art to distinguish and elevate themselves. This track specifically comes after a struggle with addiction and dysphoria, recognizing the self-destruction and pain that's caused by that, and it serves as a public apology and a reminder that the only power we have is to change ourselves for the better. After that, we have Tom Légère with Toujours Mieux, released as a single on October 27th. This is a Montreal-based rock, lo-fi, electroacoustic artist. And this is the first track from his upcoming solo project. He's also known as the drummer and singer of the Montreal duo Valse Fréquence. And then after that, we have Bloc Perrant with The Long Night, released as a single on October 31st. They're a Winnipeg, Manitoba-based alt-rock post-punk group. And this started as a one-off tribute to the LA band X and kind of emerged from there. So without further ado, we're going to kick it off with Adieu Narcisse and Jamais right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. This is What's Brewing.
De fond.
Finished listening to Bloch Perron with The Long Night. Before that, we had Toujours Mieux by Tom Leger. And at the very top of that set, Adieu Narcisse with Jamais, right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. This is What's Brewing. We're getting into our last few tracks. So without further ado, kicking things off with Sunday Club and Nuclear Fallout. This is off of their EP Bannatyne, released October 31st. They lean more shoegaze, and they're from rural Manitoba, based in Winnipeg. This is in anticipation of their debut album with Paperbag Records, so keep an eye out for that. And then after that, we're going to finish things off with Carrie Matisse and The End of the World, released as a single November 5th. This is a Toronto-based alternative dream pop artist. She's also a poet and singer-songwriter with an undergrad degree in opera and a master's in creative writing. This specifically is a song about wondering how the world could go on without your best friend in it, and the hope that she has for the people who define our lives waiting for us when it's all over. She also has a mini movie coming out in anticipation of her upcoming debut concept EP. This is her second single, so definitely go check out the rest of her music and some of the visuals she has to accompany them. But without further ado, Sunday Club and Nuclear Fallout. I'll see you guys next week. CFRC 101.9 FM. This is What's Brewing.